I'm hearing about some interesting beers. The Stedgi Brewery in Iceland, for example, uses pure Icelandic water. Good start. It's also flavoured by whale testicles, which have been smoked in sheep dung. It's reported to taste like a porter with hints of caramel and a smoky, almost meaty aftertaste. Colin Peacock, you couldn't make it up.
No, you couldn't. I'm just starting to feel slightly unwell now.
Yeah.
So say that again. Whale?
Whale testicles, which have been smoked in sheep dung.
Okay. And that's a beer?
That's a beer, yes, from the Stedgi Brewery in Iceland.
I'd just like to know if it's clear or cloudy. By the way, I'm not drinking it.
Colin Peacock's here for Midweek Media Watch. Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well. What are we going to be talking about today?
Well, a few things. First of all, it was the so-called Night of Nights of the news media, their main Journalism Excellence Awards. Last Friday, the Voyager Awards. So Voyager being an internet company which took over the sponsorship a couple of years ago. And actually, we caused a bit of a fuss the first year they took it on because C.B. Woodhouse, internet entrepreneur, was his idea for his new company to sponsor the awards. He came onto Media Watch to do an interview about it because we thought, well, why does an internet company, they're not involved in content creation, they're just pipes, you know, why is he bothered by it? It turns out he'd been living in the States after he banked a lot of money from selling his internet companies. He came on Media Watch and said, you know, I've got real problems with the coverage I see. And I see all these problems in the States. Mm. With the media lacking money and the lower quality of news, the quality of news sinking. Come back to New Zealand, I think it's just as bad. And he was actually bagging the industry that he was bankrolling the Night of Nights for. And
wow.
It was slightly controversial, but fun, and it was an honest interview.
It's like the reverse of biting the hand that feeds you.
Yeah, kind of, because he was the feeder. Yes, yeah. So I guess if you've got the feed, you can do the biting.
Yeah. You make the rules. No one's going to tell you off, are they?
Yeah. But I mean, he must have not annoyed them too much, because I gather he was at the event last Friday, presiding over the ceremonies. But I mean, you would have read a lot, I guess, in your news websites and your papers since then about who won from the particular publishers of those outlets, because what they always do, it's a bit of a shame, but they only ever trumpet the gongs that they win. So when you pick up your Sunday Star Times or whatever, you'll find out all about that. So here's some of the headlines which followed the awards the following day. So, Stuff claims swag of top honours at 2019 Voyager Media Awards. RNZ journalists win four categories at 2019 Voyager Media Awards. Herald crowns milestone year with big night at the Voyager Awards. And yeah, this is kind of a shame because, you know, you want to know about excellence in New Zealand journalism, who really won. But for some reason, all these media companies suspend their normal rules of what's important in a news story and just talk about themselves. And RNZ is as guilty as anyone, by the way, of just highlighting their four winners. But my favourite was the ODT had a slightly more modest heading, which was ODT photo team does well at awards.
Oh, bless.
Yeah. And scanning the story, no mention of any other award, you know, who might have carried off the Supreme Prize for New Zealand journalism or best paper of the year or something. So it's a bit of a shame. I mean,
are you surprised by that?
Nah, I mean, it's always been the same. And there's nothing wrong, of course, with readers of a paper being told by the public, hey, look, you know, you enjoy this product, you pay for it, and look, we did well, and you know, this is a quality product you're reading. So that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is supposed to be about acknowledging the award-winning work of other publishers and broadcasters, but they just hardly ever do. It's not meant to be about tribal or company glory, and it's just a bit of a shame, and I just wish it was not quite like that.
But more collegial.
Yeah, and the odd thing is, it's a real contrast. Like, on the night itself, I was just looking at Twitter, and of course, a lot of journalists on that, and they're all, they've got a very different approach. They are more collegial. You know, they are congratulating each other when they're rivals or from other companies, of course. There's a sort of we're all in it together vibe when they were tweeting each other and congratulating each other. It's a shame that's not reflected by their editors and publishers.
I noticed that too, actually. It was very kind-spirited and sort of happy and joyous among the journalists, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's a good thing because it's an industry under pressure, as we know, and one of the messages coming out of it, when you look at the quality of work and the quality of the people who are getting the awards, you know, the problem isn't necessarily the reporters or the quality of the work they're putting out. It's just the economic problems of the business. But there was sort of one exception. I just thought it was a shame. But RNZ's Phil Pennington won the prize for Reporter of the Year. Now, there was virtual social media silence. A couple of RNZ colleagues tweeted, oh, good, he so richly deserves it. And he really does. But, you know, I just thought it was a bit of a pity that other journalists wouldn't recognise the absolute nuts and bolts sort of work he's done on stories that aren't especially glamorous, but really significant, like, say, the stories that he's done, several, about poor quality steel and bad testing of steel. And a Commerce Commission ran an inquiry, fined companies heavily over that, New Zealand Steel and Tube and so on. So, you know, just a shame that more journalists, I think, didn't recognise that this was a really richly deserved award. And actually... He's not a self-promoting kind of guy.
Well, he's not a big social media guy, is he?
Well, that's part of it. I actually thought he wasn't on Twitter at all. But it turns out he is. When you look at it, he is his Twitter handle at PJPen with two N's if you want to look it up. But kind of funny, 78 tweets, all but one, were purely requesting interviews and contact details for people for stories. So he's purely using it as a news-gathering tool, not as any kind of self-promotion. But he did get a bit of credit, actually, on Monday. He was back on the job, not resting on his laurels of having won the Reporter of the Year prize. He did a story about Oranga Tamariki shortcomings for Morning Report. And after that, when he'd done his sign-off, Susie Ferguson and Corin Dan gave him a bit of credit like this.
And Phil Pennington has just been named Reporter of the Year at the annual Voyager Media Awards. The judges commended his work, saying he doesn't chase headlines but serves the public good. Phil Pennington's portfolio of stories included Middlemore Hospital's leaky buildings, the transport agency's compliance problems, the contamination caused by chemicals in firefighting foam, and supposedly celibate Catholic priests fathering children. Congratulations, Phil. It's 19 minutes to nine.
Yeah, top stuff, Phil. I was actually talking to Phil the day after he won that award, and he was happy, as you can imagine, but he was a little bit grumpy about one thing on the night, and that was, so Phil is a vegetarian. And he informed the Voyagers that he was a vegetarian and he would be eating a vegetarian meal.
Right.
And everybody else's dinners came out and it was beautiful-looking steak and pork belly. And Phil sat down, Phil's plate was presented to him to see a fried egg sitting on a bed of rice.
That was dinner for the night.
Yeah.
Now, see, if he'd been more of an outgoing Twitter user and social media show-off,
maybe they would have known.
We would have seen that picture, and he could have tweeted his grumpiness with an appropriate hashtag, but that's just not his style. Yeah, so funny. I mean, yeah, interesting. We thought he literally wasn't on social media. Yeah. Actually, one of his colleagues, Megan Whelan, the head of digital at RNZ, tweeted, like, all you need to know about Phil on awards night is that on his way flying to the awards, he actually stopped on the way to the airport to catch his plane to do an interview related to a story. So, yeah, so richly deserved. And, yeah, just a shame about the catering. I didn't know that.
This is good. And celebrification.
Yeah, this actually, it was the awards that sort of triggered this in a sense in me as well. Before and after, there were lots of, you know, as I said, we were looking at it via Twitter, lots of social media where the reporters were joshing each other about the hangovers they were going to acquire because they cut loose on the night.
Party like a journalist.
Yeah, exactly. And there was one from Clark Gayford, partner with the Prime Minister, soon to be husband. He tweeted this, "Shout out to all the NZ journos who this morning will be grappling with the ethics of using Uber Eats to order a blue Powerade and a proper kiwi pie. Hashtag Voyager Media Awards 2019. Now, that's pretty witty. Just a light-hearted tweet, of course, and I feel like a bit of a crank even bringing it up. And he is, of course, a media person, right? Yeah, program maker himself, if not an actual journalist. But I don't know, there's just something about it. I look at that and I kind of don't like, you know, the first bloke so-called buddying up to the media elite like that in a tweet. It just sort of rubbed me up the wrong way because I think that sort of thing does feed the suspicions of those who think that the media lean to the left and are a little bit too close to the politicians who are of the same persuasion. And, of course, he is a guy who is in the media himself a lot.
I was going to say that it's an awkward kind of position to be in, isn't it? Because Clark Gayford will be on good terms and have many friends in the media. So I suppose there's a delicate kind of balance to strike in a way.
Yeah, so that's why I feel like a bit of an uptight crank bringing it up. But the thing is, with the reporters had hangovers or not, there was plenty of Clark Gayford in the media of the weekend. On Sunday, for example, big travel feature by him in the Herald on Sunday. Clark Gayford fishing charters in Samoa deliver the goods. Premium content, by the way, so you'd have to pay to read it. And his mug was also on the cover of the Sunday magazine in the Voyager Award-winning newspaper of the year, Sunday Star Times.
There we go.
Yeah, for this profile piece, so first man, his picture. And it was one of those really dull interviews where the journalist met him in a restaurant, and the first part of it is what they ate, what he looked like, and it's the sort of British newspaper magazine style of feature writing, and it's just not all that interesting. I picked out a bit, and it says, an hour earlier, while posing for these pictures, you know, because it was a photo shoot as well as an article, our photographer asked Clark to think about the past year and let those emotions play around on his face. I don't know what face to give, says Clark later. What aspect? There's a lot of moving parts. I mean, why would you even put that? It just tells you nothing. It's not a vivid image. It's not anything. So, I don't know, just waffle. But where it got interesting was later in the profile, the reporter said that Clark Gayford went on to say there are subjects now he's learned not to speak about because it can be controversial or create a problem for Jacinda Ardern or the government. And the reporter says, this is a quote from the story, Gayford is a good conversationalist on any topic, but he's passionate about the environment, climate change, the interconnectedness of ocean ecology, kina barrens, crayfish numbers, riparian planting, rising sea temperatures, and it goes on and on. Now, this is actually pretty interesting because these are genuine live issues. You know, he's concerned about the state of our fisheries as a guy who does a fishing show and spends a lot of time when he can out on the water. But, you know, no follow-up. This was skated over and it was back to what's it like being the first bloke and the nappies and baby Neve and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's just really disappointing. And, I mean, there's too much of it. I feel like I've been exposed to more Clark Gayford than I really want to see. And I know people are interested, but it's not as if other publications aren't doing that stuff. And it seemed to me, if you're not going to talk about the really interesting topics, such as ones he really is passionate about, well, why bother?
You can imagine the reaction, though, of the Prime Minister's press team should Clark Gayford weigh in with his opinions on such weighty issues.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe I should give them credit for actually addressing it in the piece and saying that, well, you know, it could have been a different type of interview if he'd felt more free. But the thing that, I don't know if I would bring this up at all, but for the fact that, you know, in those Sunday magazines, there's a little column by the editor, usually about something that's in the magazine. So in this one, the editor, Emily Simpson, under the heading The Clark Lark, she said that this interview made her think of the journalist Deborah Hill Cohn because of a column that she once wrote, which we ripped into Clark Gayford because seemed to her he was enjoying the celebrity status too much. And you might remember that
I remember one. That well. Yeah, there was a big fallout from that, wasn't there?
Yeah, because it was just very bitter and mean. But, I mean, she writes very idiosyncratic columns, or did. She stopped in November 2018 at the Herald. And some of these are very personal, about her own foibles and, you know, really out there. And some of them a bit uncomfortable to read. But anyhow, this one, she really tore into Clark Gayford for no apparent reason. Now, the reason that Emily Simpson brought this up was said she thinks that it's actually a misunderstanding and it's really a chore and a hassle to be a political spouse in the public eye. But, you know, to me, you know, why would you think of Deborah Hill Cohn? It just seems to me these media people are thinking too much in their own circle. Look at Clark Gayford, media product in the interview, and she's thinking of it in terms of what other columnists and Auckland-based journalists have written about him. It's all a bit too circular. I think it's just an example of the media people being a bit too interested in themselves than even their own readers are.
That kind of linked in a little bit to the Voyagers, actually, because I was kind of thinking about this a couple of days ago, and I was thinking, do people really care about the Voyagers?
Well, it's not about them. It is about the business and about journalism. So it just doesn't really matter if they do or they don't. And, I mean, it's just one day only. The day after the awards, they'll publicise them. So I don't really see that as a problem. Mm. But the thing that struck me as an irony, though, was that in bringing up Deborah Hill Cohn, Deborah Hill Cohn is really aware of what's going on. She wrote a column following up that controversial one about Clark Gayford the next week, saying, what was I thinking, attacking him? And she said, it turns out I can be unattractively sanctimonious when I see others who are still embedded in this media circus. When that piece about Clark Gayford was published, I grimaced. I hit myself in the face. I know I'm the worst, you know, so quite self-aware. Mm-hmm. And when she stopped in her Herald column and wrote her last one in November last year, she said, look, I'm giving all this away. I feel a lot better now that I don't have to worry about this stuff. She said, I'm just like everybody else, a normal level doofus. Sometimes just recognising you're a regular shitty person feels like a special kind of accomplishment, better than even winning a literary prize. And then last month she reappeared, having been out of the public eye, the column had finished. She reappeared in the Herald's glossy weekend newspaper magazine Canvas, kind of ironic. And she had really fascinating reflections on checking out from this whole media circus. She says, I've become a convert to the delights of being invisible. I'm not on social media anymore. I have a strange lack of anxiety about being ignored or not invited to things. I don't feel the need to go out much, and when I do, I don't put on lipstick. I don't care. I just like being inconspicuous. He says, it feels kick-ass to realise that I might be invisible to you, but damn it, I'm no longer invisible to myself. And she says, I love this bit of self-awareness. She said, the wrongness of me now writing publicly about being invisible doesn't escape me. But hey, take what is useful or completely ignore it, either is fine. So I thought the self-awareness of that was a real counterpoint to the kind of boring magazine feature, that one with Clark Gayford, where, you know, it just struck me that, I mean, the article about him was the product. I mean, him appearing in the media was the object of the article and the subject of it. And, you know, having gone through this whole period of exposure, you know, come out the other side, Deborah Hulcone figures actually it's just not worth the bother.
The Australian election had a prominent gimmick on election night that rubbed you up the wrong way.
Yeah, the Bish boot. I wasn't so bothered about it, but it was pretty corny. So a really brightly coloured set. And I suppose, you know, now there are so many digital tricks available, and for something that lasts as long as an election night broadcast, and a pretty competitive field, I guess, with Australian commercial TV channels would all be covering it, and there would be money at stake from the audience and advertising and so on. So they got in former Foreign Minister, I was going to say Bronwyn Bishop. Is it Bronwyn Bishop?
I can't remember.
Bishop. Anyway, she's Bishop.
And Julie Bishop.
Julie Bishop, yeah. And she famously wore a pair of bright red shoes to the press conference where she dramatically quit and left the government. And these have apparently become semi-iconic. I don't know what you call it. So Channel 9 turned these into an animated boot that could then be swung. And if you want to see this, go to the Media Watch page on the RNZ website, Media Watch Midweek. It's up at the top of the page there, and we've got little Twitter links and a video that you can actually see this if you like, and see it in action. But here's what it sounded like anyway. This is the Bish boot being trialled, because every time an MP was confirmed as having been kicked out of Parliament, they would have one swing of this animated red stiletto with Ms. Bishop wielding the axe.
What will we call it tonight? The Bish boot? Is that what we're calling it?
Well, yeah, that'll do.
Let's see. Hang on, why am I first?
Well, Roscoe, you're out.
May as well be you.
Why am I crash test
dummy? May as well be you. So give us a countdown.
Can I say, that thing looks like it's going to hurt.
I promise I'll be gentle, but let's go. Right. 3, 2, 1. Oh, he's gone.
That'll leave a mark.
That hurts. Is there anyone you would have actually really liked to kick, Julie, that we could have put in there?
Yes.
It's pretty different to a New Zealand election night coverage, I would
say. Yeah, you really have to see it to get the full glory. It's very corny. She looks very uncomfortable, actually. And it turns out she said just before that on the broadcast that those red shoes of hers are actually in the Australian Political Museum or something. So a bit like, I'm trying to think, what would the New Zealand equivalent be like in, I don't know, an election or two elections time, that, you know, Paula Bennett has the, you know, Westie leopard skin boot print something, and it's in Te Papa, you know, the, you know, I don't know.
I'm trying to think back now.
Yeah.
Muldoon's whiskey bottle.
Something like that. Well, but that really would be significant. Yeah, he called the election when he was under the influence and so on. Yeah. But this, I mean, just, it seems a bit like, I don't know, he's fetishizing these boring thing. She wore a pair of red shoes at a press conference. So what? But there is a hilarious clip of her wielding the Bish boot and looking absolutely ashen-faced because she had to do it for Tony Abbott. And of course, she served in his government, and she did not like doing it. And it is because there's a little disc with Abbott's face in the boot swings that goes flying over the studio. And she, you know, had to play along having agreed to do it.
I bet she looked a bit uncomfortable.
She looked extremely uncomfortable. And I thought, this really is pretty crass. Mm. And maybe, I think it might turn off some of the viewers, but this is, of course, the channel that brought you Daddles the Duck and its cricket coverage. Does that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah. Cricket, back in the day when someone would get out for a duck, a little animated duck would come out and go, wah, 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 and then sadly sort of, oh, have we got some audio
of it? It sounded
like
this.
Okay, here we go.
Try gone for a globe, first rock. England 6 for 197. Ooh, in trouble. Duck. Walks backward, Daddles the Duck. Take your pads off and watch Graeme Swann walk out.
Bottom line, Sean Marsh gone first ball. You'd have to question why he was actually playing it.
He is on a hat-trick as Ricky Ponting trudges back for a golden duck. It's 2 for 2.
How's my duck?
It doesn't work so well on radio.
Not really.
Little cartoon yellow duck tucking the bat under its arm. But they were doing that, I think, back in I think 1982 or 81 made its debut.
So, is that right? I had no idea it was that old.
They're still doing it. So while I don't think the Bish boot will survive another election, Daddles the Duck. So they're into their animated gimmickry.
Indeed.
And were even before fully digital era, I think, at Channel 9. So maybe we'll give them the credit. They must have a unit somewhere that tries to think of animated gimmicks
exactly.
they can deploy in which situation.
It's creating jobs. Game of Thrones fans. The Herald has drawn the ire of some Game of Thrones fans.
Well, they did. They ran a spoiler story, but heavily,
signposted.
Yeah, so big health warnings on the top saying, in fact, it said, spoilers ahead for Game of Thrones Season 8 finale episode. If you don't want to know what happens, turn away now, in capitals, so right at the top. So you couldn't be deceived. But this is, I think, even while the broadcast was airing, it was very soon after. Mm. But this is a story they nicked from their partners, news partners, News Corporation in Australia, so news.com.au. That's where the story generated, so it would have run on their site first. So they ran the story, but it was giving... Like, everyone knows what happens now. I can actually talk about what it was, can't I?
Look, if you haven't watched the final episode of Game of Thrones and you're still planning on doing so, tune out now. There we go.
Okay, so the line in the story was... that Jon Snow double-crossed his lover Daenerys Targaryen. Is that how you say
well
it?
Done.
Yeah. Stabbing her in the chest in the throes of passion. THROWS.
Oh, a good old-fashioned typo.
Yeah, and that's wrong. But it's kind of weird because given that, as I said, they nicked the story, were republishing a story from their Australian news partners. I went and checked their website and it's correct. And this was pretty soon after it was published. So somehow they managed to introduce the error because they spelled it correctly in Australia, THROES, the throes of passion.
So some eagle-eyed sub-editor has accidentally...
Or autocorrect has
gotten it wrong.
But I wouldn't mention this at all because, you know, there but for the grace of God goes every journalist. And we've all done it. But, you know, this is managing to spoil their own spoiler story with a typo. So there's an irony there.
There is a further irony in that I'm actually getting some heat from our listeners for saying irregardless earlier.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, when I was putting this on the Media Watch page, I thought I better not make any typos because I'll look like a fool. And I wrote media self-absorption, and I looked at it, and I spelled it absorb with a P.
With a P.
And that's correct. And I was right.
Really?
Is it absorb? Because you say absorb with a B. But no, I was absolutely correct. So, I should back myself more often. But once you start pointing out other people's typos, you are making yourself a hostage to fortune.
I think there is a law along these lines called Murphy's Law, which is a switching around of Murphy's Law that goes that if ever you are in the process of correcting someone else's grammar, your correction will also include a typo or a grammatical mistake.
I like it. But, for Game of Thrones, I mean, honestly, it doesn't matter that much. But it is funny, again, following the Twitter feeds of journalists as we do, you know, how many of them were deciding they had to bail out of Twitter. Of course, they share a lot of news and comment because for like 2 hours before because they were afraid of spoilers. From, I guess, people in the United States. And it didn't occur to me, because Game of Thrones is not a thing for me.
No.
I mean, I don't have, you know, the pay TV services that it screens on, but Prime TV does run it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a new box at home, so I recorded the free-to-air episode, whatever it was, the final one, and the one before. Never having seen a frame of Game of Thrones, I thought I'd have a look. And this is one of the dragons flying around and burning everything.
It's okay. We've done the disclaimer.
And I just thought it just reminded me of what they call George Lucas disease in the trade. And there was a brilliant BBC documentary when they refloated the Star Wars franchise again. They'd done the first three, Revenge of the Jedi, and then several years later they started the franchise up again.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford was interviewed in it. And he was talking about telling George Lucas how terrible the dialogue is. He said George Lucas would hand him these scripts and these, you know, lines that I will not stand by while my people suffer and die. And he said he handed it back to George Lucas and said, George, you can type this crap, but I can't read it. It was just that bad. And I had that feeling as well. Very little dialogue. It was an action episode. You're looking at it, think, if you looked at the script for Game of Thrones on paper, it'd be incredibly sparse and, you know, really basic kind of language. And there were a lot of people looking freaked out and just staring at each other, and then some exciting dragons, and and some battles, and I just can't get it. I don't know what it's all about.
Unbelievable shade.
Think, well, this is apparently, they say, that 95 times more popular than any other pay television program on its own.
Oh,
I don't know how that could be measured.
Yeah, that seems like a great set.
But that seems to twin with the intensity with which people talk and write about it, yeah. The New Zealand journalists included. But I just can't see what the magic is.
Outrageous.
Maybe I came in at the wrong point.
Colin Peacock declares war on Game of Thrones.
No, I'm not declaring war on anything. I'm just saying it's not for me. But literally looking at it, saying, what is it that, even if it's not to my taste, what is it about this that has people quite so wound up?
Yeah, I think
can't miss it. And I'll even turn off my social media to avoid knowing what happens next.
I think you might have started watching at the wrong time, Colin.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah,
never start at the end. We've got about a minute and a half to go. And so should we talk quickly about some tearjerkers?
Yeah, really quickly. And again, go to the Media Watch page and have a look at this. All the links are there if you want to see these. Interesting, there was a story about a 19-year-old from Amsterdam looking for her dad, a New Zealander who was her father, who had parted ways with her mum in the 90s. And Christian Harrison of Stuff wrote about her and reunion. The dad has now made contact with her daughter from Amsterdam, and everybody's happy, and that's great. But the BBC have kind of put that in the shade a bit with an extraordinary story about a guy called Amar, an Iraqi orphan who thought he was an orphan. 25 years later, he's been reunited with his mother, having thought they were all dead, killed in the same napalm attack by Saddam Hussein's forces in Basra. Wow. In the early 90s, in the first Iraq war. Extraordinary story. All came about, and the link to this is how Amar found his mum, BBC podcast. A BBC local cameraman filming on a railway station, getting a tip off from a guy who just came along to see who he was and what he was doing, and told him that this guy had just had social media contact from Iraq, that his family might still be alive, and they followed the story. It is absolutely remarkable.
Incredible. And where can people see that? On the BBC website, presumably?
Yep, or on our Media Watch page. Just go there, look for Midweek Media Watch. Down the bottom, it's the last story on the page, full links to the BBC Panorama program and the podcast, How Amar Found His Mum.
Great stuff. Colin Peacock, Midweek Media Watch. Thank you so much.